The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or to view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
So if I give a very quick summary of what we're talking in the first lecture, we reviewed the first and second law. And of course, I assume that you all have seen in various courses. And this is the maximum thermodynamic efficiency of any heat engine operating between two heat reservoirs. One is cold, the other is hot. So that's the key point. And then for many of you, probably first time, I introduced, if you go to the statistical side, the microscopic picture, at one quantum mechanical state, you count how many particles, either electrons or molecules, or photons, or lattice vibration photons, and for electrons, it's given by Fermi-Dirac distribution, and where this mu is the chemical potential. That's the energy you need to take a particle in or out of the system. And E is the energy of that quantum state, and T is the temperature. And then say that's for electrons, where the Pauli exclusion principle, or say the maximum possibility of having an electron in a quantum state is 1. So this number is between 0 and 1. And then I introduced also the other type of particles, those photon, electromagnetic wave, or lattice vibration, we call photon, or even molecules. This is the Bose-Einstein distribution, where, again, this is the energy and the mu is the chemical potential. But here, we're not limited by the Pauli exclusion. So in one quantum state, this number can be larger than 1. And if you take out this minus 1 or plus 1, you go to the classical regime where we call the distribution F. Doesn't have that one, the exponential distribution, that's the Boltzmann statistics, Boltzmann distribution. This is what you see in Arrhenius law in chemical reaction. So that's a review of thermodynamics. And then I went down to heat transfer, where we have three modes of heat transfer. The first mode is a heat conduction. The Fourier law tells us the heat flux is proportional to the thermal conductivity and the temperature gradient. But I went one step further to show you in a very simple kinetic picture, just to count the number of molecules going from left to right and right to left, then we have a simple expression for thermal conductivity. That's 1/3 C is the specific heat, V is the velocity, and the gamma is the mean free cost. That's how long the molecules travel. So this is the heat conduction mode, and then we have the Newton's law of cooling for convection, where the heat transfer is proportional heat transfer coefficient, area, and temperature difference. And the difference is this heat transfer coefficient is no longer a property of the material. Thermal conductivity is a material property. And H depends on the flow configuration, natural convection, forced convection, what kind of geometry. And then the third mode of heat transfer was thermal radiation, and I gave the Stanford-Boltzmann law as the maximum emission for an object can have in the so this is called the Stanford-Boltzmann law. It's proportional to temperature force power. A real object, the emission is less than that, so we normalize the real object emission by this number, we get the so-called the emissivity. That's the It's a number between 0 and 1. So I moved up my arm at the end of last lecture. I was trying to show you the thermal radiation can be derived, the and here I'll continue, and give you a derivation of the Planck's law. Again, now we move from continuum to a microscopic picture. And once we go to microscopic, I use the same strategy. I'm going to do the counting. The number of modes, quantum mechanical state, because I already know from statistics, each quantum mechanical state, how many photons. That's the Bose-Einstein distribution. That's the previous slide here. So I know each mode, this is the number of, at this temperature, that's the number of photons in the modes. And also I commented before, for photon Coulomb, this mu equals zero. So we'll use that, and the task is really just count the number of modes. So I will take a qubit, and I assume that the wall is perfectly reflected, and this is at a temperature T. And now I want to see how much is radiation energy is contained inside this cube by counting the modes. I want to show you this because we will actually use a lot of those counting techniques towards electrons, towards the photons. So it's a general way of doing the counting. And of course, we have, it's an electromagnetic wave, so here are basic relationships, and you know the wavelengths times frequency equals the speed of light. So I write it rather than wavelengths, I write it in terms of wave vector, it's the inverse wavelengths, and angular frequency, so omega equals it's a linear relation between the amplitude and the, of the wave vector. Wave vector is a vector, so it's kx, ky, kz in Cartesian coordinate. And that's what we call the dispersion relation. The relation between wave vector and frequency is dispersion. So now I want to see how many modes in this cavity. And then my simple picture is this is the length in the x direction. And because the perfect wall, so it's reflecting and it's a wave, so the only way that this wave can exist is having zero amplitude at the end of the on the surface of the wall. So this is a, if you have a string and you want you do the go to think about you play violin and you have the notes at the two ends and the vibrational modes at the two ends zero. So we have different modes. First mode is a half, and the second mode is including the full period, and I can use this as my constraint. In the x direction, that's the length, and the half modes are twice or n times the half mode, half wavelengths. So with that, I go to, because the wave vector in the x direction is just 2 pi over lambda, so I can write this in terms of n and lx, the length of the box. And if I can write kx, I can same way write ky and kz, so I have allowable number for this kx, ky, kz. And then each set of kx, ky, kz, right, if you think about the wave, give me a distinct wave. And that's one mode. Except in electromagnetic wave, you learned before, it's a transverse wave. The sound wave is a longitudinal wave, right? When I speak here, I'm pressing the air, and the direction of propagation of the wave is in the same direction as the air, say, doing expansion and compression. So that's a longitudinal wave. The transverse wave, electromagnetic wave from the sun, that's direction to the earth, the k vector. But the electric field, the magnetic field is perpendicular to the direction of propagation. And I have two, so I put a two here. And then I sum up all the modes, so n number, each set of n number, nx, ny, nz, is one mode. So I count how many modes there are inside this cavity, so I just sum up all possible combination of n, each one combination of one mode, each mode has a polarization vibration direction, and then each mode, the photon has energy, every photon has energy h omega. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. How does the factor 2 relate to the fact that the electrical field is transverse to the wave vector?
So, when I have one set of nx and y and z, so in one case, the electric field is this direction. In the next case, is this direction. All other is a combination of the two, so it's not fundamental mode. So you have factor of 2 is because in this one set of nx and y and z, you can have two possible E directions, electric field directions. So I do my summation here, and the only thing, this is the trick I will use many times. I don't like summation because I don't know how to do it easily analytically. So I'm converting that summation into integration. Right? So if I think about the n are discrete and the wave vector discrete, but if this separation between the energy is small enough, so I can say in this distance dkx, and this is the unit of this discrete, so that's equivalent to a continuous number of n, rather than discrete number n, right? So this is the equivalent of summation into integration as long as this function doesn't change a lot between the every two n's. And I do that for y and for z. So this is this step is just for my future, okay? What this step means, rather than doing this factor of 2 here, from 0 to infinite, which is a standing wave, okay? N is an integer, positive integer. It's a standing wave. I'm going to do from negative infinite to positive infinite, because this is a even function, okay? And this way, I'm really, rather than, so what I miss is this factor of 2. I don't have factor of 2 anymore. And physically, what I'm saying is this standing wave summation is same as 2 propagating wave, counterpropagating wave. When kx is negative, it means going negative direction, positive goes positive direction. So this is mathematically equivalent. Later on, I'll do a lot of this minus infinite to plus infinite summation rather than just standing wave summation. Right? So, it's more mathematics. I can walk you through, but there's no physics here. It's a book content doing the lab. I already did the dkx, dky, so I wrote it into Cartesian coordinate. Now it's not x, y, z, it's a kx, ky, kz, it's Cartesian coordinate. And three-dimensional integration, the rest is just the numerator here I had before. Those numerator lx, ly, lz, right? So 8 pi cubic. So that's just a copying what I had before. And x omega f is a serial copy. So I'm doing all the copying. Now, to simplify, again, simplify life, the integration, you can say I have a conflict. The conflict is y is integrating over k, but my function is a function of omega. So I have to transfer either y into omega into k or k into omega. And I would like to transfer k into omega in this case, and it's your choice actually when you do it. So I transfer that k into omega, and I want to do spherical coordinate, because that's easier. Okay? So dk dx, dkx, dky, dkz, 4 pi k squared dk in spherical coordinate. And now you go to look at the kx squared, right? I hope I've written down, okay, in the previous slides. Okay, kx squared equals omega squared divided by c squared. So this is how I change k into omega. That's where the dispersion relation, the relation between omega and k, is very important. Okay? So K into omega, that's just omega equals CK. So dK is d omega d over C. And now I combine everything. I do per unit volume how much energy we have. And I write all those other factors into the integration. And this is what I have here. Everything is math. And this D, I call it density of states. What it means is how many quantum mechanical states or electromagnetic modes we have between around omega. Okay? And so this is the photon energy, one photon, one state, how many photons we have, and then in this state, in this region, how many states we have, right? So this is also the energy density. Yeah, I write everything together, it's just energy density in the, at this frequency. Okay, so this is the energy density as I wrote down, and if I want to write it out, density of states, F, and the H omega is combined. That's Planck's law. Planck's black body radiation law. The energy density per unit volume, and these were actually the start of quantum mechanics. Okay, Planck was trying to explain the black body radiation. And if this is not called, say, because the energy states, in fact, most of the time we don't talk about energy state, we talk about radiation leaving a surface. Not just how many energy in per unit volume. Okay? And in that case, the definition is the intensity. Energy flux per unit solid angle. What is a solid angle? A solid angle is if you have a two dimension, you know a polar angle. XY. From XY, you want to use a circle, polar coordinate, you have polar angle. And in three dimension, that angle is a space, angle in space. That's a solid angle. It's per unit area, normalized the distance r squared. So a sphere, the area is 4 pi r squared. Right? The solid angle then is 4 pi, because r squared cancel. In 2D, what's the phi? 2 pi. 2 pi versus space, 4 pi. That's the solid angle. So with that's the because that's the terminology we use often. So this intensity is just now. I know the energy density per unit volume. This energy is propagating at the speed of light, right? So is energy density times C, and it's going radiation. Thermal radiation is going all directions. So per unit solid angle is 4 pi. So this way, I write the speed of light times energy density divided by 4 pi, that's the intensity. And this is just so you go continue substitution, you get the intensity. And sometimes we do per unit wavelength interval rather than per unit frequency interval. So rather than doing d omega integration, you do d lambda integration. And because lambda is times omega equals 2 pi c, so you convert the omega into lambda. Again, this is a when you actually take a radiation course, this will be the Planck's law that's written over. And what's the so that's a per unit solid angle, and when I do the total radiation per unit area, so this is the per unit the area. Times area, so that's the total radiation, is a pi times I. That's the mathematical, we're not going to get into it. What I want to show is, from here, if you do your integration, you get Stefan Boltzmann law. Okay? Stefan Boltzmann law, if you take a 2.5, is where we start on thermal radiation. And what I give you is a way of going from basic concept to go to the Stefan Boltzmann model. But say, what's important is for you to look at the curve of black body radiation. This is very much relevant to the way we want to do solar cells or solar thermal. Because the sun radiation is about 50, here I wrote 5600, but it's really around 5800 Kelvin. That's the solar radiation. It's like a black body. The spectrum is very similar to this curve. Okay, outside the atmosphere, if you go to measure the solar radiation, it's close to that 5800 Kelvin curve. And at 300, I didn't plot, 300 Kelvin, this peak will be around 10. So here you can see the peak starts decreasing, and that relation is the wind displacement norm. Wavelength times temperature is about back of the envelope of 3,000. If you don't remember that detail, whether it's 2,898, in fact, every time I go back to check, I remember it's about 3,000. Okay? So 3,000 micron, and that's why our eyes are sensitive to 0.5 micron. We live in the solar system, and the solar radiation, if you put about 6,000, 3,000 divided by 6,000, our eyes, the evolution chooses us to be most sensitive to the peak of solar radiation. Right? And during night, there's no sun, everybody's emitting, you're emitting, I'm emitting, we're emitting 10 microns. Right? 300 Kelvin corresponds to 10 microns. Of course, if you take a detector, you can look at it, right? So yours like that, the infrared radiation measurement. But if you look at just a common, a solar cell, right? Silicon solar cell, the wavelength that they can take, the shortest wavelength is about 1.12 micron. So 1.12. So this is 1 micron, this is 1.12. So only radiation in this range can be utilized in solar cells. You have a lot that's wasted if you do think to a silicon solar cell. This rest of the wavelength energy cannot be used to generate the electron holes. We'll talk about that later. Okay, so that's a completing what I was talking in the review in basic heat transfer and the thermodynamics. What I'm going to move on is giving you a brief introduction of thermoelectric energy conversion. In the last lecture, you have seen a basic demonstration of thermoelectric generation. And in fact, this is the module that used to generate the power. I'll toss around. Take a look. And basically here, we are using direct energy conversion. We're using electrons or holes. In semiconductor, we have names for positive electron and holes. And we're using this as a working fluid to carry heat around from one place to another. So let's look at the phenomena, basic thermoelectric phenomena, and then we'll do a simple analysis of that device and pass it around, and then look at the current and the potential application. First, the thermoelectric effect is not new. And in fact, this were about the same time people start to investigate the electricity. And Seebeck discovered in 1821 that when he put the two metal actually as a junction, and the one side is hot, the other side is cold, they measure a voltage. Seebeck, now we call it Seebeck effect. And Seebeck himself, actually, if you go to read the history, he didn't know what's going on. He thought that was a magnetic effect. Because at the time, there were a lot of interest in magnetic Faraday or the experiment. So he thought that was a magnetic effect. And about 10 years later, Hal Kidd discovered another effect. That's the same kind of junction, two metals, pass a current through it. Actually, one side cools down, the other side heats it up. He couldn't make ice at the time. Okay? In fact, Seebeck, if we choose his material to make a device, even at that time, a power generation device, you will get about a 2 to 3% efficiency using this material. Nobody built a power generator, so at the same time, people were starting to develop electrical motors. You can see the history was really interesting. Well, if this one actually worked out first, there will be a lot of study in it, and it will be different, right? Let's say this effect is reversible. You just pass a current first, one case, one direction it will be cooling, and the other direction it will be heating. And so both those were experimental discoveries. Thomson did a theoretical prediction, and Thomson's prediction is that, based on the experimental discovery and his understanding of the effects, he predicted that when you have a material, one side is cold and the other side is hot, so a material under temperature difference, and you pass the current through it, there will be heating or cooling along the material. So this is not jar heating, okay? Jar heating is always heat. This is reversible. It will be either heating or cooling depends on the direction of the current. That's Thomson's. Thomson is also Lord Kelvin, and you'll probably see a lot of Kelvin work, Kelvin relation for this, Kelvin relation for that. He published more than 500 papers. Very productive in his lifetime, right? So, now let's get a very intuitive picture. We have to go to, for those understanding, we have to go to microscopic again. And we now have to look at electrons. Let's look at the electrons. And I'm going first to just look at the isothermal. There's no temperature difference in the material. Or isothermal conductor, there are a lot of electrons inside. And apply an electric field, the current will flow, right? We all know that. So I have a current flow. Now, again, I'm doing number counting now. This number, what's the current density? Current density is an amp per meter square, is the charge per electron, right? Times per unit volume, how many electrons I have, times the velocity of those electrons, moving. It's very intuitive, right? So you go to look at the unit, you'll be m per meter squared. And the velocity is related, I'll give you the relation more later on, through an electrical field, and this the coefficient, proportionality coefficient is called the mobility mu. I'm relating the velocity of the electron to the electrical field. Again, this I'll give more detailed derivation. And of course, that will be the Ohm's law. The current is proportional to electrical field, and the proportionality constant is the electric conductivity. And sometimes we don't talk about conductivity, we talk about resistivity, just 1 over the conductivity. So this is the Ohm's law, and all the definitions, their units, given here. So this is when we talk about the electrical flow, we typically care about current. But each charge also carry heat with it. I can do the same thing for heat, right? So rather than the charge, electron charge, I'm going to say the heat carried by each carrier. I don't define how much, how I write that heat yet. I'm just saying per carrier, Q is the heat carried by each charge. Again, number density, velocity, the movement. And of course, I can replace NV by J, the electric current. So now the heat current is proportional to electric current, and the proportionality constant is the Pauli coefficient, right? So associated with the current flow, there is a heat flow. So Pauli coefficient can be defined for each individual material. You don't have to have a junction. The junction is only when you do an experiment, how you observe it, okay? So this is the, when I want to observe the Pauli effect, the best way is to put a junction there. I have two different materials. And when I pass a current through, and you can say the current has to be, electric current has to be continuous. That's a Lambert, right? Electron Lambert, in and equals out. So that's the continuity, current continuity. But the heat carried by the electrons in one material could be different from the other. So if I do my first law of energy balance, I find out if I have more heat flow out, then comes in, I have to supply the heat. So what does it mean, supply the heat? The lattice cools down. The atoms cool down, because I'm talking about electron, right? The atom can supply the heat to the electron, cool down the junction. So this side can cool down, and then on the other side, you'll have to reject that heat. Energy balance. Right? So this is the Pauli phenomenon you observe experimentally. And then you can say, if I reverse current, this phenomenon also reverse. So this is the Pauli effect. Okay, it's reversible. Now look at the Seebeck effect. There's a seep here. Okay, Seebeck effect. Right? Seebeck effect is the voltage generation under a temperature difference. And you think about, we have charge in the conductor, and then when one side is hot, the electrons near the hot side have more energy, right? The more violent. So they will diffuse to the cold side. So you have, at the end, after diffusion, you have more electron here. When you have more electron, the electron imbalance will happen. You have an electric field building, right? The internal electric field will resist the diffusion. So at the end, you have a steady state where the diffusion current balance, the electric field will drive the current back. So this balance will give you the Seebeck voltage. That's the process here. Okay, the Seebeck voltage is defined, I put a leading sign. So this is when you do an experiment, you want the one side is hot, the other side is cold, you put a probe, normally you say, okay, like, the definition, I put a hot probe on the high temperature side, positive voltage on the high temperature side, negative voltage on the low temperature side. And if you do that, here it's written very clearly, you should have put a negative side in front. That's the definition. I remember first time I measured a sample, I just got the wrong sign. I didn't know why. Everybody measured differently.
Because people normally just say feedback voltage is the voltage divided by delta T. But then when you do experiment, you have to see which side is positive. Okay? Thompson effect. What Thompson effect is when you have a temperature difference and then you flow a current through, and then if you look at every point, there is a Peltier coefficient, right? The Peltier coefficient can depend on temperature. So that means when current flow in, the energy carried in could be different from the energy carried out. So the heat carried out could be different from carried in, and then that difference must be made up, cooling by either cool or rejected. So that's the Thompson effect. And Thompson coefficient is defined the local amount of heat absorbed or rejected versus the gradient divided by temperature gradient normalized the current. That's the Thompson coefficient. Okay, so we have this phenomenological, very kind of wave explanation, and now I want to do more detail. I want to put this into more mathematics into it. Oh, I forgot to mention here, Kelvin, of course, Thompson. Well, Kelvin realized, based on his understanding, those three effects are interrelated, and he actually gave the relation between Peltier coefficient in Seebeck times temperature, and Thompson coefficient is the Seebeck derivative with respect to temperature. Okay, those are temperature dependent properties. Like I said, let's go to the device, and we want to say, based on this, what are the material properties I want? So I show this device, and again, you can buy it commercially. Particularly, some of you may be interested in versus competitions. MIT has different competitions, and if you want to build this device, it's not expensive. This is $10 to $20 commercially. You can buy one. Okay, and the basic concept. Now, in a cheaper device, you see a lot of legs. They are electrical. There are only two electrodes. One is in, the other is out. So electrically, they are connected in series. And in fact, most of these devices are made of opposite type P and N together. A P-type semiconductor, N-type semiconductor. And then in the N-type is the electron carry the current flow, and the P-type is the holes, the positive charge, right? So when I pass a current, of course, current flow against the electron along the positive charge direction. So you can say that's the, in terms of device, how it works. They carry heat from one side to the other. And on this side, they reject the heat. On the other side, they cool down. So you can do the refrigeration as well as power production. We show the power. Here is a simple demo of the cooling. Right? That's the ice. You convert the water into ice. Okay, let's look at how the device performance depends on. We show the thermoelectric, three thermoelectric effects, but in reality, it's a solid state material, so there are other effects goes on when I have temperature difference. And the first one is, of course, heat conduction, right? When one side is hot, the other is cold, heat will flow. This heat could be heat conduction. Electron can conduct heat. Lattice also conduct heat. So you have both electron and lattice. This is different than the Peltier coefficient or Seebeck coefficient. So we have the Fourier law, and if it's 1D, I integrate it. I get the amount of heat transfer is proportional to the cross-section area, thermal conductivity, and the temperature difference divided by the length. say this in 2005. And if I group all those parameters together, AKL, I say this is the thermal conductance. We probably defined thermal resistance before, but the reverse resistance, just conductance, is just the inverse of the resistance. Right? So this is the definition. The thermal conductance is the KA over L. And just as a comment, very often we write it and it just looks like math. But when you actually do it, it matters a lot. Because here, if, for example, the heat flow is inversely proportional to thickness, right? So in the technology development, if I use a film, L is of the order of micron, and if I use a bulk material, L could be probably hundreds of microns or millimeters, and that heat flow is a several order of magnitude difference for the same delta T. So whether in reality you have different problems, sometimes it's a Q interface, right? Like the solar. Solar radiation Q interface. And you want to build your system to create a delta T because it's a thermoelectric device, it's a proportional delta T. So that's one type of problem, right? There are other cases where delta T is fixed. Give me an example. There are people looking into ocean delta T generation, right? In the ocean, there is the top and bottom temperature difference. You got the different problems, and then you can go to back to the most basic picture to think about your system. Sometimes that's always the first step, okay? Now, let's look at the device. Again, the real device has many repeat units of this T and N. And if I have just an ideal device, how much cooling I can create, I pass a current, and the cooling is the difference at the junction on the two materials, so one positive material, Peltier coefficient, times a negative material, Peltier coefficient, times current. So that's how much cooling I can create. Right? But in real situation, what happens is that when this side is cold, this side is hot, the heat will flow back. This is solid material. You can't get rid of that heat conduction. So heat will diffuse back by conduction. That's one non-reality, say non-ideal factor. The other non-ideal factor is when I pass the current through, I have jar beating. I didn't talk about jar beating, right? That's unavoidable part. I don't have a superconductor. In fact, you don't want to use a superconductor here. A superconductor, electrical superconductor, is a only one quantum mechanical state, the entropy is zero, doesn't carry heat. Electrons do not carry heat in case superconductor. Okay? So, there's jarring because of finite electric conductivity. And I have to consider both reverse heat conduction and jarring. Now, if I think about jarring, the difference between conduction is this side is hot, this side is cold, heat go conduction. The jar heating is uniformly generated along the lag as approximation. So in that case, jar heating about a half go this way, the other half goes the other way. Right? You can solve the equation, you'll find that's the answer. But that's the intuitive argument also. So in that case, the real lag cooling I have is in addition to Peltier, I have half of the jar hole heating, this is electrical resistance, and I have a reverse heat conduction, that's the thermal conductance of the two leads. So, that's the mathematics, the resistance, electrical resistance proportional to the resistivity of both legs, area, length, and here thermal conductance, the both and P and N, combined together. Okay? And now you can see the amount of heating or cooling I create depends on the current flow, right? I squared. One is linear, the other is squared. If I drive the device too hard, I generate too much heat. I drive the too little, doesn't have enough cooling. So there's optimum there. When you drive the device, there's optimum there. It's easy to find the optimum. But see, I want to find optimum not only for cooling, but also for efficiency. So I have to calculate how much electrical energy I give in. You say I square R. It's not that simple. There's a little trick here. Because there is an I square R, so voltage drop is I times R, that's the ohmic part. But when there is a temperature difference, there is also a feedback voltage. Right? So when this side, one side is cold, the other side is hot, there's an additional voltage you have to overcome, the internally built voltage, feedback voltage. That's the feedback coefficient difference times delta T. That's the voltage you have to overcome in addition to resistance. So the electrical power is I times V, right? So that's the W, that's the electrical I put in. So the efficiency, according to our definition, for refrigeration, we talk about coefficient of performance, right? We don't talk about efficiency. So this is what I want, the cooling. This is what I pay. The pay is the power. The power is the current times voltage. So I have I square R, that's the Darwinian. I have to overcome the feedback voltage. So that's the term there. So that's the bottom part. That's what I pay. And the numerator is what we derived in previous slides. The cooling is Peltier, but that reversing conduction and the jar. So now you go to optimize it. And this, yes?
Shouldn't feedback the longer to be reversed?
No, you wish that's the case.
Huh?
You wish that's the case. When you have a delta T, you have to push current, you can see. Okay. When I have a current flow for cooling, this is T, this is N, I flow current this way. Okay? But this side is hot, the voltage is against here. Okay? Otherwise, you get too easy, your problem. So, you go to optimize your current, right? That's the arithmetic. You can T phi di equals zero, and you find the optimum current, and then find the optimum, under optimum current, you got to maximize efficiency, or COP. Okay, of course, I dropped all the math. And let me again make a comment. You go to say your cooling COP, that's easy because there's no denominator here. You got an optimal current for maximum cooling power. Here, you got an optimal current for maximum efficiency, but the two do not agree with each other. And in fact, in your operation, you want to adjust your current just in between. You can't satisfy, you go optimal current, you don't have much cooling power. Okay? So the other point is, you look at this, you see the familiar term. This term is all thermal energy. That's a Carnot cycle for refrigeration. We wrote down Carnot for power generation. But this is a Carnot. So it's a Carnot factor, it's a heat engine. And of course, you want to make sure this term is less than one. Right? You can't be Carnot. And here came to this factor Z. That's thermoelectrics. Every time people see you, what's your ZT? This is where it came from. Z times temperature. And this T is the average temperature between the hot and cold side. And this Z, again, this is all coming from this mathematics, doing derivative. And it's the feedback difference of the two material. And the denominator is the conductance, thermal conductance times electrical resistance. So you look at it, it's not a material property at all.
right? It includes the material's property, feedback coefficient, electric resistivity, thermal conductivity, but it also depends on the cross-section area. And they look at this function, you want to maximize your ZT to get a higher efficiency. So the first thing is that you go to maximize your Z by geometry. You can reduce the denominator by changing your L over A, right? That's the least you can do if you don't work in the material, and that's what you want to minimize. And if you minimize it, it turns out this is what you have to do. The K times R, this is the minimum when the length cross-section area of the two legs. So your engineer, this is where when you build the device, you optimize it. Okay? And when we do that testing in our own lab, sometimes it just involves hand polishing all this, trying to make it match to each other. So you want to get a better performance than others, right? Okay, now you succeed in your best case, you do everything ideal, that still is not a ZT. That's still not an individual material property. It depends on both sides, right? P and N type materials. So basically, if I want to make a good device, I need a good N, a good P, and the two should match each other. One material, you get a you look at the best performance, right? You can see. And you get about half of the performance if you have a good one material. But because at the end, using the tool means you have to make a lot of choice. In materials research, people just talk about one. Your engineer, you know you have to go to get both materials. Right? If somebody has one good time, you say, do you have another? You're eager to ask me. Go find others who has the other time. So this is when material scientists just say, I discovered material with high Z. That's S per sigma over K. Okay, you want a material with a high electric conductivity, and so you want to minimize geometry. You want a material with a high seedback coefficient. Seedback coefficient fundamentally is the heat carried by per charge. Okay, we'll talk more on that later. So average speaking, per charge, how much heat carries. And then you want a thermal insulator, a low thermal conductivity, because what you don't want the heat to reverse back. If you know any materials, let me know, okay? People have been searching this for centuries. Good material with good electrical thermal conductivity, poor thermal conductivity. But also, you want that every electron carry a lot of heat. That's the tricks. And this has to happen in one material.
How
same material.
So we derive the Z max for a junction?
Huh? This is the only, well, Z max, you need you compute the device, you need two materials. Right? Well, theoretically, you don't need two materials. You can do one material. In fact, in that case, what people choose the other material? They choose a superconductor. You just don't do anything. So that's how they characterize one material if you want to do a good job. Right? But see, the point is, in material research, you can't wait to get a true material and then report ZT, right? Get one material takes many years. So you do a simple material, you say, this is a measure of how good is this material. But as an engineer, you want to build a device, you have to say, where's the other material I need? I need both materials. Okay. So those are the comments that is made. You have to optimize the engineer, you have to optimize the lag. And you need two types. And you optimize the device performance, load matching. By current, right? This is a Kumi. So, here is some typical number.
for the business generator, let's say commercial device, mostly you can only buy this type of material-based device. Seatback coefficient is about 220 microwatts per Kelvin. Electric connector between the phase K, 701.5 watt meter per Kelvin. This is all SI units. It's good to keep in mind, except that, okay, micro, so 10 to the minus 6. The equivalent of the lamp is ZT, is about 1. And we'll talk how good is that. Now, what's the problem? If you have all the slapper, you say, okay, this is, I think, a leg 2 millimeter long, electric connector to phase, cross-section 1 millimeter square. So it's a small device. If you look at the device I pass around, that's the dimension roughly. Each leg is only 20 milliohms. Very small. You go to buy a resistor, it's actually very hard to buy this small resistor. What that means? It means if you want to build a single leg device or two legs, because the current is a voltage divided by resistance, right? You push a harsh, huge current. You need a big power supply. So you go to look at it, even your leg, we have a big power supply, a small drive, a small device. And at the end, that means cost, so everything you have to consider. And that's why some people do micro device. You can actually shrink your area, right? You do a smaller cross-section area where you put a lot of those together. In that case, you get a higher resistance by putting more of those legs together. So in our the device I showed the cost around, this is about 100. So if you multiply 100, it's only 2 ohms. The total resistance if you own sell the device like that. So it's a small resistance slash current device. Okay. So that's the reason to put them in series is getting higher resistance so that your power supply is easier. But say still a pretty large current, and then you put them thermally in parallel because they carry heat from one side to the other. Electrically in series.
When you optimize your system, then do you really get the simple number 112?
What simple number of
1 millimeter, 2 millimeter.
Oh, you mean no. This you can change. You can make a long leg to test it. You will still get the same delta T.
When you optimize the system.
Optimize means also material cost. Right? The real world is not, let's say, just you have to match to your application. You don't have to fix to the geometry I pass around. And that geometry is in commercial production because, in fact, each application maybe is different. But the part of the market is too small. So people are just selling more standard modules. When anything you go along standard, you have to talk to manufacturer and see whether they can manufacture it or not. Okay, so this is an example. This we built before. This is actually measuring two legs. It's a lot more difficult than measuring a device. Because anytime you put a thermocouple there, you have heat loss. Heat loss, your performance may diminish, right? If you want to say what's your maximum delta T or that. So it's a lot of time to glue in and doing the experiment. You have your leg is milliohms, so anytime you have missing color in solder, the industry they do much more, much better. I looked at a production line, I was really amazed at what an untrained worker can do versus what we can do in the lab. That's the different environment. It's, this is the 1P, 1N, and this is a measurement curve. You can say it's a large, pretty large curve. In this case, we go one peak along line X when it's with that device. Right, line amps and the each leg is about 1 millimeter cube. So this were, and what's amazing, even with that small thing,
and this side is 100 degrees, the other side is zero. So you can drive pretty large to the other T if you have the control.
But efficiency is not very good. Okay.
The materials is temperature dependent, I mentioned this before, and the analysis I gave you is for constant temperature.
So if you do real device design, you have to go solve differential equations and match the property, consider all the temperature dependent properties. And that I'm not going to cover in depth. Anybody wants to do that, you can read the book. This is the energy balance in differential form. And this is the heat conduction term. This is Thomson term. This is general heat. Okay, so that's a differential equation, locally. And very often people use differential analysis to drop the Thomson effect. And then the boundary has the Fourier term and the Tauchnik term. So you have a boundary condition and a differential equation itself. Again, this is beyond what I want to talk in detail. And now let's look at where those technologies are. I have the expression for COP, and you do the same analysis for power, and you get the efficiency for power generation. And the efficiency of power generation, again, has ZT inside, and this factor is slightly different from COP, but you go check it, it's probably universal, not one. And this is the power factor, right? Again, it's a thermal engine. The power times whatever your material. If you can drive the power, you win big in this. You have time ZT, you can drive the power. Okay? And so this is not so accurate. I made this slide around 95, 96. And this is the temperature ratio of hot to cold in Kelvin. And this is the efficiency. And what I put down here is the thermoelectric is at the bottom. Okay. It's not a rosy picture at first. You have to do a lot of research. Right? And the power plant is about 40%. Right? The normal coal-fired power plant is 40%. Internal combustion engine is about 20%, 25%. Right? What I did not put here is solar. Solar depends on amount of silicon is about 6%, single crystalline silicon is about 18%. Once you think about that, then your picture becomes better, right? You can, in fact, the LOXA uses thermoelectric power generator, that's about 67% in the deep space missions. But now in the lab, there are people developing thermoelectric generator using ZT about one material, that is around 12 to 14%. 12 to 14% radio to level, that's actually very attractive for some applications. So really, it's application dependent. You don't at this stage, we're not thinking, it's not at that level to say, I'm going to replace major power over, in the sense, power plant. You're not even there. Internal combustion engine, but there are many different sources where you can potentially use it. And there is a refrigeration. We've given this before. Right? And COP, again, depends on temperature, right? And COP of thermoelectric compared to household refrigerator is about a factor of 5. So that's actually probably the hardest if you really want to say the application. You know, say, really replacing the refrigerator, I think probably for the long time. But again, there may be other applications where you can think about the cooling. And in fact, the current market, as I'll show later, is mostly in the cooling area. So this is where really the engineers, you can, so you need to say, I know the technology, they need to say where it makes sense. There are different areas that they could make sense. And commercially, mostly standard size. When standard size, the people offer different size, but the geometry is very similar. The height could be, in the case of our generator, the actual feature is about 5-6 millimeters, and the cooler is typically millimeter in height in the next. And the top is ceramic, right? And the top, around, top bottom is ceramic. And in between, the next feature connected typically by copper. So the technology-wise, they have to put actually a diffusion barrier between the copper and the material, because the copper easily get into material that can poison the material. Okay, in terms of applications, these are the most standard small coolers. This is because when you reduce the compressor, compressor actually the smaller you make, the hotter in terms of it's hotter to make the heat. When you make a very small compressor, of course the moment hot is a problem, and this becomes more attractive. Solid state becomes more attractive. A lot of the dormitory hotel refrigerators are made out for thermoelectric. And still the efficiency I think is still not as competitive, but the cost could be very effective. And then it could be as small as just a laser diode. And the people, in fact, put a lot of multi-stage to create a larger ability. Each stage is this highest about 6 feet together, you can create a ability commercially, 150 to 160 going. So the infrared detector very often needed to be cooled to put those multi-stage infrared detector. But many laser diodes has a thermoelectric cooler. This is because the wavelengths in telecommunication, the wavelengths of this laser will break the temperature change a little bit. So they actually use thermoelectric to stabilize the temperature. Not much for the heat, but for the stimulant. Macroequipment, DNA, we have to compare denaturalization and recycling. And probably a really good commercial example is this company called Amerigo. And they started putting a device in the, this is where you have to look at where it makes sense, right? They started to manufacture around 2000. Somewhere like a cool seat. And in some high-end auto automobiles, now they have a market of about 2 million models in the automobile the car seats. That's, I still don't have this in my car. It's a luxury item. And quite successful. Now the DOE is trying to even get rid of the main air conditioner. And the idea is that the main air conditioner in automobile requires about 6-7 kilowatt. And the purpose is to turn the engine on, air conditioning on, you want to cool the whole compartment in about 5 minutes. Right? But normally you don't need a high large compressor. So the question is whether you can use this distributed cooler into the automobile. I'm not sure whether it will be successful, but there's a program like that. And in fact, this is when you think about it, where they make sense, right? They find the seats, not your office seats. Your office seats you move around. Once you get the car, it's there. They plug in the power because this needs a power there, right? So, any other places it could be using that?
Movie theater.
moving the other sheets.
That's probably too big.
I was thinking about the bed, right? But say there are actual products there. You go to, I was thinking before that I looked around, there are products already. I guess the key there is whether it's physiologically comfortable. And also how you reject that in, right? If you reject it to the same room, does it make sense at the end? So there are, those are all the places where you are, if you're an engineer, you've got to think about where it makes sense. And where you have a product people accept. And with the more product into the market, of course, there's material is also improving, then you have potential
further advancing the technology. Power generation. The main driver in the past is space missions. So once you go beyond the Mars, the solar radiation diminished. So in Mars, most of the power still come from the solar panels. Although there are thermoelectric cooler, thermoelectric generator, and sometimes those generator purpose was actually to keep the electronics warm, amazingly. Right? In the you go to say beyond it's very cold in the night. There's no power. You need the electrical power to heat up the electronics. So the space mission, most of those deep space mission are thermoelectric power. And that's a good news because Galileo, for example, sent back signal for more than 20, close to 30 years. Galileo, eventually the signal was not lost a lot because of power generator, just because the mission was abundant. Voyager, all those were based on thermoelectric generator. And then in there, they use nuclear source. So actually, I went to one deep space conference in Albuquerque. It's interesting. In the conference outside, there are people, space missions, so there are outside people protesting. Because most of the space missions are nuclear-driven power. Okay, the terrestrial application. This is a standalone generator where, for example, this company, Global Thermoelectrics, they've done good business because they sell those power generators along the to big oil companies. The oil company needs to monitor their pipelines. The pipelines, say you go through Alaska, there's no electrical power there. So they actually use the oil to generate the heat and the power generation. Body power watch. I don't think it's very commercially successful. The company, first company trying to market it, it was a Japan company, Seiko. I went to visit them. At the time, they said $3,000 a piece. It's a model powered watch. I couldn't afford one. But say, it's amazing that the watch only needs one microwatt. Right. 1 microwatt. That's what I learned from the trip. The temperature difference is one degree Kelvin, a degree Celsius to develop for this watch. And there was a lot of companies, Canon, I think, I didn't go to check their watch, but I heard they are still on the market, they're selling $300. This one went to, I went with this, and they say, well, it was sent to Smithsonian. So to the history, but I think Canon companies still sell about $300. I don't have much. I don't need a watch. Okay. But some people are developing body power you think about the low power electronics here. Right? Some of these devices don't really require a lot of people. The other day I met an MIT professor in the E department. He said that he can generate a few hundred microwatts, which is pretty good. and I saw Philips trying to also develop it, the body power. And in fact, it might be worth the calculation to say, I think Philips is trying to develop. If where you put the body, the delta T, right? One of the prototype I saw is more like around the head. Maybe it's good if you generate enough power for the poor kids to read it, like an LED now, how much power of LED is. It's interesting to check. This were actually talked a lot recently. Not because this will create a lot of seething in the thermoelectric generator, but this will be a technology that that will really make the cool area people burn. Because look at say a lot of places people are still cooking using wood, right? I know where I grew up. Say not my place nowadays, but my grew up where I used wood. And in this wood, if you ever use wood cooking, you'll know that the smoke doesn't burn efficiently. And what Philip developed is a fan generate power from the temperature difference of the burning and then drive the burning process clean. So it's a clean wood burning, wood burner. And now I heard that they are trying to market, but they still, this is about $10 to $20, and poor people still couldn't afford it, $10 to $20. And so their market is now first to get to World Health Organization to buy it and give it to the poor people free. So there are a lot of, and this one, if we can get all the people use it, it's a tremendous, their analysis actually, of CO2 problem, right? Because about 2 billion people are out of grid in the world. A lot of people burn those wood stove. And if you make those wood stove efficient, it will reduce a lot significantly CO2 consumption. So the point is, at this stage, you have to think about where it can make sense technologically. Well, at the same time, say, of course, none of you are interested in developing more efficient, better materials. So, I go to a lot of material conference, thermoelectric conference, and one sense, in the past, the last conference was very different. But in the past, you see more than 90% of the talk on materials. And not many talk on systems. So this is where I think the system, the engineer actually can make a good contribution there. Because a lot of times people just say, I have the ZT, I'll be making a difference. But ZT is only half of the story. Because if you look at a typical system, right, where the cost will come from, most likely it's not in the generator. That's thermoelectric. It's an important part, but it may not be the dominant. So think about this is objectively cool. The difference of thermoelectrics from solar is a solar cell you put in the sun, that's your system. You manufacture out, you just need a frame and put there electrical and the rest is it's about half the cost, right? Balance of system. The inverters, all those other stuff. But it's a much simpler system. Here, for thermal system, you have to establish, you have to be able to maintain the temperature difference, right? So that means you have to take the heat out or put the heat in. And I once did a calculation for a system, and what I found is the electrical, thermoelectric material is only about a few cents per watt electrical. But the cost that come from all the aluminums that the well, I didn't do a very good thermal design, but that costs a few dollars per watt. Okay. Because how you maintain the heat sink and do the cooling could be easily dominant in your cost. Not always, you have to do a good design. And the other is, if you think about the temperature, right?
So you need, for example, household temperature is about 22. Think about your refrigerator. And inside the refrigerator, let's suppose you want 0 degree. So you say, I need a 22 degree delta T. But that means your 22 is your refrigeration compartment inside, your air outside. Now you have to transfer that heat to the cold side. So this cold side must be lower temperature than 22, right? So let's suppose a 15 degree. I give you a degree delta T. And then the hot side, I reject the heat. You don't want the heat reject has to go to the air. So I have to have another delta T from here to here. I give another 5 degree. Okay, that's 12 plus 22. So I need a 39 degree rather than 22. Now you go to 39 COP versus 22 COP will be very different. Right. So your system is really a very critical part of the consideration. That's the significant difference of those thermal systems. It could be more expensive than the thermoelectric side. Same thing if you think about automobile, right? The automobile, let's suppose you want, this is a hot gas, and you put the thermoelectric here, this is the exhaust. And then you cool this side. And you see, what temperature this system will operate? Let me suppose the device operates at a uniform temperature. Not a good design, okay? But say, I suppose a device operates at a uniform temperature. Then the hot gas must have a higher temperature as it exists. This temperature of the gas must be higher than this TH. Otherwise, heat cannot go from gas to the hot side. Right? Heat only goes from a high temperature to lower temperature. So that means if the gas is 600 degrees, the amount of heat that you can take out is from 600 degrees to whatever this temperature. So if you do optimization, it's about half. Because you need to take that heat out of the gas, put it into the device. So that means your hot side can only operate at 300 degrees. Right? So you can't do your calculations based on 600 degrees delta T, what's my COP, what's my efficiency. And now, of course, you can be more innovative. You say, okay, I don't operate at the same temperature. Each section I operate at a corresponding higher temperature, and my efficiency, system efficiency. So there you got a lot of the system design. It depends on material availability and cost, weight, particularly when you do automobile, and with that cost is everything. And so a lot of what I say is there's space for both sides. There are a lot of problem engineers can make an important contribution, and a lot of problems of materials, ZT improvement can improve good after get a good contributions. Right. You look at the say this is a not a serious work now in the automobile side because you look at where you could potentially use it. But maybe power generation, most people now working with a lot of converter. Because we get the ability is too small. Okay. And the reality is the automobile company says 3% fuel saving, they'll be happy to think about it. 3% fuel saving is less than 1% system. So if automobile exhaust is 1/3 of the wasted energy there, 1/3, let's take a half of the heat, if I can intercept a half of the heat. So that's 1/6. So my system efficiency, if it's 6%, which usually can be done using steroid from a, not system, just a device, maybe 6%. Right? But then the question is, when you put all this together, your hot side, your cold side is really the temperature, it's 100 degrees now. But you internalize not good. So you have to think all this to put them together and make you have good impact. Okay, yeah, so the BMW is a very aggressive things, whether they can put in the market when home, right?
talked about this before, industrial history, the uniform. And then it's really up to you to find them where it could be possible. It's not competitive against IC, not competitive against main mobile. Let's say there are a lot of places where it could be the same place. Okay. Any questions?